Now, chapter 4 of Honest to God is entitled The Man for Others. It's a rather striking title. And in this chapter, the bishop deals with Christ. Now, obviously, if he rejects traditional theism, the bishop is faced with a problem as regards Christ. Traditionally, Christ, of course, is regarded as God incarnate. One of the reasons, perhaps the main reason, why the Quakers and the Unitarians are excluded from the World Council of Churches is the fact that they don't, or that they can't, regard Christ quite in this way. So that the question arises, if there is no God, if the traditional conception of God is not valid, then what is Christ? If he's not God incarnate, if he's not the second person of the Trinity, then who or what is he? Now, there's one thing about the bishop's approach to this problem which I was very happy to note, because it's rather Buddhistic, and that is that the bishop kept firmly to the middle way in this question. Now, what do I mean by that? He's quite aware that the traditional conception of Christ as the incarnate second person of the Trinity must go. That's one extreme. But he doesn't go to the other extreme, as some liberal Christians do, of regarding Christ just as a very good man. He doesn't go to the extreme of thinking, as it were, well, there are lots of good people in the world, and Christ was just a bit better than most, perhaps a bit better than all of them, but essentially just a good man. He doesn't go to that humanistic extreme. So this, as I've said, is very interesting to Buddhists, because Buddhists look at the Buddha in rather this sort of way, avoiding extremes. What do I mean by that? I've tried to make it clear in other lectures in other places, but let me just briefly recapitulate for the purposes of this talk this evening. The Buddha obviously isn't an incarnation of God, because in Buddhism there is no God. But at the same time, he's not just an ordinary man. Some scholars, writing about the Buddha, sometimes say that the Buddha was just an ordinary human being. But that isn't quite correct. In fact, it's not at all correct. The Buddha, we conceive of in Buddhism, as an enlightened human being. And by enlightened, we mean a human being who has become fully, perfectly assimilated to reality. To put it in very popular language, rather imprecise language, which Buddhists might possibly take me up on, the Buddha is a human being who has become one with reality. With reality, of course, in the spiritual, in the transcendent sense. So we don't say that on the one hand the Buddha is God, nor on the other that he's merely man, but an enlightened man, a man become one with reality. So that the two are interfused. You can't say which is the human being, which is the reality. Which is the reality, which is the human being. So there's neither a sort of supernaturalistic assessment of the Buddha, nor a purely humanistic one. So it seems to me that the Bishop of Woolwich is, as it were, working his way, almost struggling towards a similar conception of Christ. can't regard him apparently as God incarnate, but at the same time he doesn't want to regard him just as a very good man, a great ethical teacher. At the same time, he takes over Bonhoeffer's idea, as the title of the chapter indicates, of Christ as what Bonhoeffer called the man for others. And the bishop makes the same point that Bonhoeffer had made apparently, that transcendence, the sort of metaphysical dimension of reality, is experienced in concern for others. That in concern for others you transcend yourself. And in that self-transcending, in your concern for others, there is a participation in absolute reality. Now, this conception is, of course, a very noble one. The idea of living for others. But, of course, even if one regards Christ as the man for others, it doesn't make him unique, as the bishop apparently would still like to think. After all, there have lived in the world many others who no less than Christ himself lived for others. One can think of so many of them, no need to mention names. The bishop, of course, doesn't say, but he might have said, that Christ, of course, died for others. But this very conception of dying for others in the traditional way is really part of the dogmatic structure that the bishop is trying to abandon. After all, we can even say that Socrates died for others. We can say that the Vietnamese Buddhist monks who set themselves on fire a couple of years ago died for others. We can say that even quite secular heroes and heroines, like for instance Edith Cavell, died for others. So this idea of living for others, or even dying for others, isn't sufficient to establish the uniqueness of Christ. Seems to me that the bishop here perhaps wants to have his cake and eat it too. To me, in this connection, in this context, of someone who lives for others, or someone who is a man for others, the Buddhist idea of compassion and of the Bodhisattva, the one who in the popular version of the teaching renounces his own salvation, his own nirvana, in order to dedicate himself to the salvation and the well-being of others, really expresses the truth which I feel the bishop is trying to work his way towards much more clearly and much more adequately. In Buddhism, compassion is not just a mere emotion, it's not just a feeling of pity. Compassion is the way in which one acts. It is what one manifests when one has a deeper, true realization of non-selfhood. Which means that in Buddhism, compassion is regarded as the flower of wisdom, wisdom being understood as an experience of the truth of non-self and of non-duality, what we call shunyata, the voidness, which is of course not just emptiness, reality itself. So only if one has this sort of experience can one really live for others in the deepest and truest sense. But to this metaphysical, this deeply spiritual level, the bishop doesn't actually penetrate. He seems to think of living for others more in terms of social service and so on, which to the Buddhist is comparatively superficial.